Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, April 30th, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a Courthouse Steps discussion on Jessner v. Air Bank following the decision issued last week. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Bill Casto, who is the Paul Whitfield Horn Professor at Texas Tech University. Also with us is Professor Samuel Stryker, who is the Dwight D. Opperman Professor of Law, the Director for the Center for Labor and Employment Law, and Co-Director for the Institute of Judicial Administration at the New York University School of Law. After hearing from both of our speakers today, we will move to an audience Q&A. So as they speak, please keep in mind what questions you have for either the individuals or for the case in general. We will have plenty of time to get to your questions. Thank you both for speaking with us today. Bill, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Hey, gang, this is Bill Casto. I thought we'd learn something about the Alien Tort Statute in the Jessner case today. I assume most of you all understand that it's a terrorism case involving suicide bombers. You know, part of the deal in signing on to this sort of short-term job is that your family will receive a significant monetary stipend if you complete the job to your employer's satisfaction. The stipend is clearly important, and the defendant, Arab Bank, seems to have directly aided this project by processing the payment of the stipend. And so victims of suicide bombers have sued in United States courts. You know, this case involves a simple and but very complicated statute that gives the federal district courts subject matter jurisdiction over actions by, quote, an alien for a tort only committed in violation of the law of nations or international law. I've been playing with this statute for over 30 years. I'm astonished. But let me tell you, just to organize your thinking, I'm not arguing pro or con here, but just to organize your thinking, it's good to think, remember that all complaints in federal court, as Julius Caesar might have said, are divided into three parts. The first part is always lays out subject matter jurisdiction. That's what 1350, the Alien Tort Statute, does. It gives the federal courts subject matter jurisdiction. Then in the main part of a complaint, you have to describe acts by the defendant that violate some law. Finally, usually it's a short paragraph, as we all know. At the very end, you seek a remedy, which outlines the consequences of the defendant's unlawful acts. Now, under the Supreme Court decisions, there are two questions. First, is there a clearly established principle of international law that makes the defendant's acts unlawful? Second, is there a remedy? By the way, in other words, you see, 1350 is simply subject matter jurisdiction. An important aspect of the complaint is that you have to establish that the defendant has violated international law. We all know that there are reasonable arguments on all sorts of issues, and we certainly don't want federal judges to be lone rangering out there giving reasonable interpretations of international law. That would give them a whole lot of legislative authority. To limit that authority, the Supreme Court has said, you know what, these principles of international law have to be very clearly established. As a practical matter today, the principles of international law that would be enforceable under the statute are genocide, slavery and the slave trade, and terrorism. there are all sorts of arguments about other things, like how about assaults on the environment? Does that violate international law? Any federal judge would say, I don't know. And since it's not clearly established, there's no legal violation. Now, our case involves terrorism, which I would be quite willing to argue that terrorism is a well-established violation of international law. Technically involves aiding and assisting terrorism. What's going on is the Arab Bank is the paymaster for the suicide bombers. At least that's the allegation. Now, when you read the Supreme Court's decision, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4, no foreign corporation liability under the Act. And the justices who said no foreign corporation liability under the Act all stressed the fact that, wow, when we hold the Arab Bank, which is a significant player in the country of Jordan, liable, if we say that they may be held liable, that's going to create very serious foreign policy questions for the United States. All five justices emphasized we want to avoid these foreign policy considerations. Therefore, we think the case should be dismissed. It's important to understand that they all said, oh, there are two questions under ATS litigation. One is there a violation of clearly established international law? The justices who said dismiss the case said we're not going to address that issue one way or another. They said, we're going to the remedial issue. Do we have discretion to enforce international law, to provide for the enforcement of international law against foreign corporations? By the way, Justice Alito specifically said in a footnote, hey, we're not addressing domestic corporate liability at all, U.S. corporate liability at all. Justice Gorsuch essentially said the same thing in the last part of his opinion. So the issue presented is, should the justices create a remedy against foreign corporations when that remedy might create serious foreign policy problems for the United States? I personally think they should create such a remedy. Gosh, I guess I'm on the losing side there. But I'll turn it over to Professor Estreicher now.
Good morning. Sam Estreicher from NYU. I don't have as long a speech to give as Bill does. This is the third of three cases in the Supreme Court which I think have restricted the scope of the Alien Tort Statute. You have to remember this was a statute, part of the Judiciary Act of 1789, at a time when the country barely had a navy, did not have a standing army, and was very, very leery of getting embroiled in conflicts with other countries. The purpose, and I think no one disagrees with this, the purpose of the Alien Tort Statute was to provide a remedy for wrongs committed on U.S. territory where the United States had a duty to provide that remedy, and if it didn't provide that remedy, it would embroil itself in frictions or conflicts with other countries. That is the purpose of the ATS. However, for the last 30 years or so, I guess as long as Bill's been working on this, this statute, which would essentially lay dormant for centuries, has been used as a wedge, as a vehicle for bringing human rights litigation in the U.S. courts, very often having absolutely nothing to do with the United States and certainly implicating no duty of the United States. So take the facts of this case. The gravamen of the plaintiff's complaint is not that the United States has defaulted on some duty owed to another state, but rather that the bank has not fully complied with U.S. law on banking conventions. The United States says there was ultimately a settlement with the Arab Bank, and now the Arab Bank is functioning in satisfaction of U.S. obligations. That's essentially the theory of the complaint. That's where the Arab Bank's liability comes in under their complaint. Now, this case could have been thrown out on the grounds that were set in Kiobel, earlier Supreme Court case where the court said that the ATS in general does not overcome the presumption against extraterritoriality, that the case has to have some connection with the United States territory, with United States interests. And the case could have been thrown out on that ground. It wasn't, because there was a conflict among the circuits over whether or not corporate liability is available under the Alien Tort Statute. I have a couple of quibbles with Bill's account. Certainly, the norm has to be it has to be a clearly established norm under international law. And we would argue that also the class of defendants has to be a class of defendants that is recognized as responsible for international law violations. This is an emerging area, a nascent area, and under the International Convention Against the Financing of Terrorism, there is a recognition that when the manager of the corporation is involved in the international wrongdoing, there should be a remedy provided. It's not the kind of blunderbuss corporate liability that has occurred under Alien Tort Act litigation, where we're bringing in corporations on an aiding and abetting theory because they're building roads in a country that has not been barred from U.S. corporate investment, and bad things are happening on those roads, which was a good example of an earlier case that I had been involved in. Now, the Supreme Court holds in this case, clearly it holds that foreign corporations can't be sued under the Alien Tort Statute. I think the reasoning of the opinion also reaches U.S. corporations, but I recognize that Justice Alito says that was an open question. I think at the end of the day it will be closed in the same way that it has been closed in this case. International law has not come to a consensus judgment that corporations should be liable for international law violations. That's the first prong of the Sosa ruling. There is a norm against terrorism, but it's not clear that corporate wrongdoers are reached under customary international law. Whenever the international community has developed remedies for serious international wrongdoing, until very, very recently, it has excluded corporate liability. So in Nuremberg, corporations were not liable. It is true that there are certain corporations that were considered simply appendages of the Nazi regime, and they were as part of the occupation authority of the armies of the United States and the other allies, they were denuded of their assets. When the International Criminal Court was created, corporate liability also was excluded. Now, it's excluded because there is not a firm consensus on what to do with corporations. In many countries, corporations are actually funded and run by the foreign state. This is certainly true in China. We have a case in the Supreme Court right now on what to do when the Chinese government claims that Chinese corporations must engage in price fixing. The Chinese corporations all have parallel ladders of authority, which are comprised of the Communist Party members who are representatives of the state. That's one problem. Another problem is how to fix scienter, how to fix mental culpability with corporations, which is one principal reason why the International Criminal Court excluded corporations. I'm personally not against an appropriate rule similar to the International Financing Convention rule that would target high-level management decisions, the knowing of the wrongdoing and perpetuating its occurrence. And that's something I think maybe the United States in some subsequent statute might put in its law, or maybe by international convention that could be worked out. When the United States passed the statute in 1991 involving human rights concerns similar in scope to the Alien Tort Statute, they attached liability only to natural individuals. When the Supreme Court had a case involving the Bivens cause of action for constitutional violations, again, it attached responsibility only to individuals. Again, down the road, going forward, there may be a basis for a U.S. statute that expanded the scope of the Torture Victim Protection Act, but I don't think we need to read the 1789 statute as doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, professors. Professor Casto, do you have any remarks before we move to a Q&A for, I guess, from Professor Stryker?
Well, just a few remarks, and Professor Stryker has identified some very important issues. First of all, on the history of 1350, the Alien Tort Statute, no one really knows what it was enacted for. It certainly was enacted with very broad words. It clearly was addressed to some specific problems. I suppose the argument that says it doesn't address today's problems is that there's a negative inference in the statute, that it only addresses the problems that the founders thought of. Well, things have changed a lot. Professor Stryker mentions the Torture Victim Protection Act, which is probably best just not talk about. It needlessly complicates things. But basically, the Act, Torture Victim Protections Act, codified a portion of this common law cause of action.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Codified what, Bill?
Codifies a portion of this common law cause of action. The Act involved a word, and there were reasonable arguments going both ways on the word. The Supreme Court simply held that, the word individual in that statute means human beings, not corporations. That's a perfectly reasonable interpretation. But you can't go from there and conclude that the entire Congress intended to do that. It was just a judge doing a judge's duty. I would love to hear questions from the audience.
Wonderful. And Professor Stryker, do you have any comments before we move to Q&A?
Not at this point.
Then let's go ahead and open the floor.
I think it might be useful if we talked about open issues. So one open issue is one Professor Casto identified, which is whether U.S. corporations are suable under the Alien Tort Statute. We talked about it. I think another question would be the touch and concern requirement of Kiobel. What does that mean? What does a defendant have to do in connection with U.S. territory or U.S. interests to trigger touch and concern? So one issue I think would be, what about a independent contractor's conduct at a military base in another country alleged to have violated some international wrong? Is that touching and concerning U.S. interests? Another open question I have a student actually working on, if there is someone who is, say, a torturer who is been given refuge in the United States, and on request the United States does not extradite that person, is there a cause of action under the Alien Tort Statute for the failure to render that person over, even though there's no general customary international obligation to render people over in response to extradition requests? But that's a fact pattern very similar to what could have happened in Philartiga if, in fact, the defendant in that case had not left the country, or had not been deported from the country, I should say. Those are two open questions.
Hey, let me break in a second. I love the torturer problem because,
right,
in my view, one of the very positive aspects of this whole cause of action is the United States does not become a retirement haven for international criminals. I wrote about this once. Remember when, was it Papa Doc or Baby Doc Duvalier
was running
Haiti?
Right. Right.
And remember, the United States cut a deal for him to leave the country, and avoid a very vicious civil war. If the State Department had said, come to the United States, clearly there should be no liability there. On the basis of, I think, I came down on it in terms of official immunity, the State Department should simply state, this is contrary to the deal we cut with Baby, I guess it was Baby Doc, right?
Well, there I agree with you, Bill. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I see it as an open question, but I agree with you that when the United States has made assurances in order to basically resolve a serious dispute, they should be honored.
Exactly. And,
so
and like, for instance, the South Africa problem.
Right.
If a country is seriously trying to grapple with the problem, we might not like the way they're grappling, but if a country is seriously trying to grapple with the problem, there should be no liability there.
Right. And that also, you know, I think the fact pattern in this case is similar to that because the United States represented that the Arab Bank had to grapple with its responsibilities, but maybe that comes in on the discretion side. Wes, are there any questions? Because, you know, I think Bill and I can talk, I think, for a very long time together. There's a lot to learn from Professor Casto.
And the same for you. It looks like we do have three questions in the queue.
Oh, great.
Thank you, callers,
good,
for calling in.
Good.
Let's go ahead and move to our first question.
This is Edwin Williamson. I apologize. I have not read this opinion, and I also, when I began poking at it and looked back at Kiobel, I hadn't realized how rusty I'd gotten on that. But basically, sort of two questions. I thought in Kiobel the court dodged the issue of foreign corporate liability and instead basically decided it on a, you know, the touching and concerning point. And so my first question is whether this is a per se holding that foreign corporations cannot be defendants and does not therefore elaborate any on the touching and concerning issue. And the second is that, this is Professor Castro referred to the concern expressed by the majority of the impact on foreign relations. Is this concern consistent with the past expressions in this area, particularly by Justice Kennedy? My impression is that the submissions that the State Department makes in all these cases, I think, have pretty much gotten to the point that they were really kind of ignored, or at least not taken very seriously. Anyway.
Well, let me try the first, just briefly the second. I think it is a per se holding that at least the foreign corporations are excluded from the Alien Tort Act reach. I think Bill agrees with me there. It's an open question whether U.S. corporate defendants can be reached. I think the logic of the court's decision does go that far, but it's a very strange decision because it's splintered. And except for that one footnote in Alito's opinion, I didn't fully understand why I didn't all join the entire opinion, but it is splintered in, on some level. So the foreign corporate liability issue is still an open one. The U.S. corporate liability issue is still an open one under the Alien Tort Statute. And the question will be whether the reasoning of the court answers that question or whether it's truly open. I think at the end of the day, it'll be closed. But right now, given the Alito footnote, it is open. What happened is that the Second Circuit ruled for the Arab National Bank on corporate liability grounds, not on touch or concern. Even though the Supreme Court had a complete record and could have decided this case, the Arab National Bank case, on the fact that this was an entirely extraterritorial set of events. They occurred in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and had nothing to do with the United States, save for these banking violations by the Arab Bank, which the United States says the Arab Bank now is in full compliance. So the court felt, given the split in the circuits, that it should answer this question. But I think on US, on foreign corporate liability, it's a per se ruling. With respect to past experience with Justice Kennedy, I need to look at that more closely. I do think the court is moving in general, and I think Justice Breyer has been an advocate here as well, in taking on a robust conception of comedy, and that the court should be leery of reading broad jurisdictional statutes to get the potential to get the United States embroiled in controversies where the litigation would be at variance with expectations of these foreign states. I just don't know whether Justice Kennedy has always honored these concerns. I can't speak to that.
Yeah, my general impression is the Supreme Court as a whole gives great deference to suggestions from the State Department. It's just that in many cases, the State Department decides not to give clear suggestions right. as to what their position is. Hey, we should look at this alien tort statute as enabling the courts to create a common law cause of action. Everyone agrees it's a common law cause of action. We apply common law reasoning. Everyone understands that if a common law court says the rule is X, in a situation where B is applicable, that is, X is no liability in a situation where a foreign corporation is present, then that decision simply does not provide a common law rule for another case where the B foreign corporation and diplomatic travails is applicable is not present. There are no foreign policy concerns when a U.S. corporation is the defendant. There simply are none. There inevitably might be issues where a U.S. corporation reincorporates in Ireland for tax purposes. Does that mean it's no longer a U.S. corporation? Or where a U.S. corporation operates overseas with a wholly owned foreign corporation? There's some difficult questions there.
And difficult questions, and they raise similar concerns where all the events occur abroad, and the litigation is at variance with the expectations of the foreign states involved in the region.
Right.
But I agree. It's a technically open question. And
yeah.
Do you have any views on Justice Kennedy and deferring to the State Department?
I think he probably does, okay? Yeah. And by the way, I think probably there should be deference to the State Department, which is the president, on foreign policy issues.
We agree there as well.
By the way, notice this, though. Suppose a U.S. corporation is engaged in slavery in a third world country in order to reduce costs of harvesting natural resources and bringing those resources to the United States to sell in the U.S. economy. To me, there is an astonishing connection between the United States and that situation. I would like to keep liability open for those for that sort of despicable
That was actually a question that Justice Kagan asked at the argument. And certainly there are ways of reaching that conduct without the Alien Tort Act in terms of our trade policy. But I understand your point, Bill.
Yeah. Here's another point. It could be that in some situations, if there is a contact between the United States and the defendant, a significant contact. It could be that state courts could recognize state tort actions and apply state law as a matter of choice of law to the problem, and that would be totally outside of the Alien Tort Statute.
Unless there's a kind of preemption argument that develops.
That's right. That's right.
But it wouldn't be from the alien tort statute, I think. It would have to be some other source. But
it would be like when the Massachusetts city said, we won't contract with Myanmar. And the United States Supreme Court said that
they found
trespasses.
Right.
Yeah, they found
so there would be a foreign affairs preemption issue.
Yeah,
I don't
sure
think
it would
turn. I don't think it would turn on. I agree with you that it would not turn on the reach of the alien tort statute.
No, not at all.
There have to be some other basis.
Was there another question?
Yes. In fact, we have three more questions in the queue.
Great.
So plenty of time, and let's go ahead and move to our next caller.
Hi, this is Carter Page. A fascinating discussion, and I'm curious, sort of
is
looking
this Carter
at the
Page,
same...
the luminary in the news.
Yeah, it's that guy.
Okay.
So, somewhat of a related question in sort of reverse engineering this, and it reminds me a little bit about debates back in the 1990s in the UK when they were doing their Human Rights Act and looking at jurisdiction between, domestic law and the enforcement of international treaties, particularly in the European Court of Human Rights. I'm just curious, just as sort of from a comparative law perspective, is there any sort of other foreign jurisdictions where there's been similar activities, particularly for, other than just in the narrow context of just looking at it from a domestic perspective here, I'm just wondering whether there's been other activities. Is the European Court perhaps one of the main jurisdictions? Or I'm just curious to hear the sort of where else there's been similar litigation.
Well, I don't think there's a similar statute out there. Bill can correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that's right.
Purports to provide a forum for international human rights violations anywhere in the U.S., anywhere in the world. I just don't think that's the case.
Are you familiar with the Human Rights Act, the UK's 1998?
One thing about the UK and the EU mm-hmm. is they have a treaty with the EU,
yes.
At least they did,
yes.
In which that treaty, by domestic law, UK domestic law recognized the jurisdiction and power of the Humanitarian Court. So that's a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, one thing that's pretty clear under international law is that the Netherlands is free to punish a Netherland corporation. UK is free to punish a UK corporation, and the United States is free to punish a United States corporation. There's just no doubt at all about that, insofar as international law is concerned.
Carter, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's there's a broad range of other questions, but it's interesting. So thanks a lot.
Well, it's good hearing from you.
We have two more questions in the queue. Let's go ahead and move to our next caller.
I just had two quick questions. One was the language touching a concern. Usually that's language that's associated with covenants, whether they run with the land, so on and so forth. So was there some suggestion that there is, and I guess this may be an easy question, but that there is some conduct that shouldn't, not be engaged in by corporations, specifically banks? Is there some precedent that says, well, hey, this bank can't, hold funds in an account for this particular individual if they're engaged in a specific type of act, whether it falls under the ATS or whether it falls under some international law or human rights law? And the second question was just a matter of it's like a minimal context analysis, which is related to the prior question, whether there is some, what is established, what is the minimum context? I think there was some discussion about whether or not the law, if there is a U.S. law that's on point, if there is not a U.S. law that's on point, can the international law be enforced? And the question is whether it can be enforced without there being some, I guess you use the language touches in concern, but some minimum context to establish jurisdiction for a U.S. corporation to become subject to the ATS or applicable international human rights or international law of human rights law.
Well, let me try my hand. I mean, Bill, I'm sure we'll have some additional points, and I may not get every aspect of your questions. Touch and concern is from property law, although the Supreme Court gave no hint in Kiobel where it came up with this phrase. I think the point here is that there's a presumption against extraterritorial application of the Alien Tort Statute, but there can be circumstances that overcome that presumption where there is sufficient U.S. nexus with the dispute. I don't think you can read more into it than that. And that's why Professor Castro was trying to come up with some examples, hypotheticals, where he saw a U.S. a nexus. On the second question, minimal contacts. Minimum contacts is a requirement for any time you bring an individual or a corporation into a U.S. court to due process requirement. I think in the Arab National Bank case, that was satisfied because of the fact that they had a correspondent bank in New York. I should point out that the Second Circuit has been pretty restrictive on whether or not having a correspondent bank standing alone is enough to satisfy a minimum contact. By a correspondent bank, I mean some sort of facility in the country to facilitate dollar-based transactions. And the Second Circuit has been somewhat restrictive on that point. But minimum contacts is a requirement for, as I said, any time you bring an individual or a corporation into a U.S. court. You may have had more in your question, but that's what I saw.
Yes, yes. And I guess the last thing I was saying, not to send it too long, was just if to the point of if there is no U.S. law on point, if the U.S. hasn't opined, I guess, in common law, in terms of addressing the international issue, then how can, I guess, how can the international, what would be the mechanism by which the international law will be enforced in the U.S. courts?
Most instances of international law establish obligations between the United States and either the international tribunal or other countries. I don't think there's any general vehicle for bringing international law claims into U.S. courts. You have to fit within the reach of a particular statute. You have to have minimum contacts. If you're asserting a violation of a treaty, you have to show that the treaty of its own force has domestic enforcement. So there are a whole bunch of restrictions on simply suing for an international law violation. Bill may have something more on that.
Yeah, here I hate to say the phrase conflict of laws, but generally speaking, everyone in the world agrees that the United States should not create rules of conduct of how people treat each other in foreign countries. So U.S. domestic law, on balance, does not create rules of conduct for foreign countries. The thing is, international law does. International law says if someone violates slavery in a foreign country, they're violating the rules applicable in their own country. And so when we come to alien tort litigation, what we have is the United States is applying rules that apply anyway in the foreign country as a matter of international law. We're not telling them what they should and should not do. We're just providing a remedy, and that's where the United States fits in to judicial.
You disagree, Bill, that outside the Alien Tort Act, and we've discussed that already, there is There is no general vehicle for bringing international law violations into the U.S. courts.
I agree with that. I was just talking about the Alien Tort Statute.
Right. Well, we've talked about that. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Tonight can be a contract issue, too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your response.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. It does look like we have one question left in the queue. If anyone else would like to ask a question before we end the call today, just please enter the star key and then the pound key. Let's go ahead and move to our next caller.
Thank you. This is Professor Selena Colares, Case Western Reserve University School of Law. I typically, when I teach cases like Sosa, Kiobel, and, the Pfizer case, I typically find students puzzled with the questions that they seem to have a hard time understanding, that the API is strictly a jurisdictional statute. And even after we go over the distinction, and I typically do a review of CIFPRO when we cover, jurisdictional statutes, remedial statutes, and substantive statutes, the distinction between the three different types of statutes. And they still have a hard time, and I get asked questions like, what particular individual conduct would satisfy the Kiobel or the Arab Bank case's reliance on the presumption of against extraterritoriality, and they seem to mix the two, meaning the use of the presumption against extraterritoriality as an element for determining jurisdiction in the federal court versus the conduct itself as a violation of the law of nations, as the statute originally states. So, what in your do you face this particular kind of questions? And one way I try to deal is with, as you dealt with it in the previous question, is by showing, look, all these questions relating to conduct and connection with the United States are relevant to the territorial jurisdiction portion, of an opinion. You have to, you can only exercise valid statutory valid authority if you have jurisdiction over the defendant. But when the court calls attention for ATS, it's really as a jurisdictional statute using the presumption against extraterritoriality. It's not looking at the particular international prescription. So, do you find the same kinds of questions and puzzlement in your students?
Hey, I'm basically a federal courts guy. I just got into this area because I found it to be very interesting. Here's a good way to look at it. In your complaint, you have to prove that the defendant violated a law, that is international law. International law is the same everywhere, no matter where its transgressions take place. The territoriality has nothing to do with whether international law has been violated. It's about the remedy. International law has nothing to do with the remedy. International law is violated, okay? But the territoriality is all about the remedy. Will we extend a remedy? So there is no doubt in the Kiobel case that, for instance, if they can prove, as they alleged, that Royal Dutch Shell was helicoptering kill teams into villages to murder and torture villagers who were protesting environmental depredations. There's no doubt that violated international law. The thing is that the remedy, the territoriality applies to the remedy and not to the conduct regulating norm. That's what you got to get the students to understand.
Let me just cut in a little bit. I think I disagree. I think that Justice Souter merged these doctrines to some extent.
Yeah.
He said on the one hand that it's a jurisdiction-only provision because it, after all, appeared initially in the Judiciary Act of 1789. But then he says that there's a question of whether there's a cause of action. Maybe that's a merits question only. So I think the presumption against extraterritoriality clearly goes to the merits. I don't know if it's a jurisdictional question, nor is it purely a remedy question. But I think it may be waivable, although I don't think the Supreme Court has ever passed on that. But it certainly goes to whether there's a cause of action. And I think the court, and that's what the court did in SOSA. And that is, I think, what the court is doing here as well. Is there a cause of action against this particular class of defendant? So I think I answered the question as best as I can, but maybe maybe Bill has some other comments.
I more or less agree with you. The thing is, a cause of action has two components, the norm and the remedy. And without both, there's no cause of action. That's why I call there's no doubt that these allegations involve violations of international norms. There's just no doubt of that. The thing is, whether we provide a remedy, that's why I say extraterritoriality.
Or a cause of action. Just put a different phrase on it. Or a cause of action. All right. Now, I want to ask you a question about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. You know, the corporate nexus requirements, is that jurisdictional or go to cause of action? So I just had a case which raises that issue.
I kind of think it's got to be jurisdictional.
Yeah, I would think so as well.
But sovereign immunity is a little different from your usual subject matter jurisdiction.
It is. I'm going to have to go, folks, because I've got a meeting here with one of my co-teachers. Thank you, Wes, very much.
Of course. Thank you for joining us, Professor Stryker.
You know, the alien tort statute says for torts only, right? That was put in specifically in 1789 to prevent the enforcement of a United States treaty with Great Britain that founded our independence. The treaty said all debts owed to British merchants would be paid, and we flagrantly disobeyed that treaty. The tort only was put in there to prevent federal courts from providing a remedy for flagrant violations of a U.S. treaty. Kind of interesting.
That certainly is. Well, as Professor Stryker has made clear, he has had to step off the call. Professor Casto, do you have any other closing remarks before we finish the call today?
No, it's just that, to me, the major battleground now is in alien tort statutes litigation is going to be U.S. corporations, or at least corporations who are wholly owned by U.S. corporations. So it'll be interesting.
Well, thank you, Professor Casto. On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.